Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.1, The Sublime Ottoman Empire. At its height in the late 1500s, under the rule of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Empire spanned across three continents, reaching as far west as Algeria, as far south as Yemen, as far east as Mosul and Baghdad, and as far north as Budapest. At its center was the great city of Constantinople, the Istanbul of modern Turkey, a city that represented the literal coming together of two continents, with Asia and Europe on each side of the great Bosphorus Strait. As a political entity that encompassed so much territory and ruled over such a vast array of ethno-religious groups, the final and complete collapse of the Ottoman Empire following World War I was a seminal event in world history, and it is the central narrative of this first season of 20th Century Revolutions. Due to its vast size, the story of Ottoman collapse holds at least some of the keys to better understanding more recent conflicts in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and North Africa. The final climax of our story will be the successful defense of the Turkish national homeland by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in the Turkish War of Independence, a conflict that emerged directly out of World War I. Along the way, though, we will touch upon numerous revolutionary events that engulfed the Ottoman Empire in the 19th and early 20th centuries, all of which were a direct cause of the final collapse of the once great empire. These include the Serbian Revolution, which we will take a look at next week, as well as the Greek Revolution, which, starting with episode 3, we will be doing a 5-episode mini-series on, so get ready for that one. Then, we also have other nationalistic struggles in the Balkans, in Bulgaria, Romania, and Montenegro, and the later Balkan Wars that eventually emerged out of these conflicts. Later on, we'll of course have the Young Turk Revolution. Then, we'll look at the Arab Revolt made famous in the West by T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, as well as Muhammad Ali's rise in Egypt and the eventual revolution there in 1919, and finally, the Turkish War of Independence and the secularizing reforms of Atatürk, which followed within the newly formed modern Turkish nation-state. As we will see, the story of the Ottoman collapse and the nationalistic struggles that resulted from it encompass many of the themes that will recur within the revolutions of the early 20th century. First, we've got the anti-imperialist struggles to establish national homelands out of the chaos that was post-World War I, Europe, Asia, and Africa, as all hell broke loose when the old world empires began to collapse, namely the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and of course the Ottoman Empire. Second, we have violent ethno-religious conflicts that emerged as a result of the effort to create quote-unquote pure national identities during the formation of all these modern nation-states. And third, we see ideological political divisions within these nationalistic struggles between things like monarchism, liberal democracy, communism, and proto-fascism that would set the stage for World War II and the Cold War. To tell the story of an empire's decline, we must, of course, begin with that empire's ascension. So, come on, guys, let's hop into our time machine and delve into the old misty past. Telling the story of the rise of the Ottomans is a bit tricky, as there are many controversies, debates, myths, and other just kind of sticky conversations that one must dip their feet into. But if we take the simplest approach, the Ottoman story begins as the Byzantine story ends. And, you know, I will eventually quit it with the Mike Duncan references, but another connection to be made here is that our story emerges nicely out of Robin Pearson's wonderful History of Byzantium podcast, a podcast telling the story of the late Roman Empire, picking up where Mike Duncan left off with his History of Rome. So all the stories are converging here. This episode on the Ottomans comes out of Robin's podcast on the Byzantines, which came out of Mike's podcast on the Romans, And as we will see, the Ottoman sultans will eventually lay claim to the hallowed name of Caesar of Rome, emerging as the successor to the Romans and the Byzantines. So yes, connections all around. Okay, so the Ottoman story traditionally begins with Osman I, who led a small beylik, which is a word for an Anatolian principality. Anatolia, of course, being the peninsula that is today the location of modern Turkey. Osman's Turkic tribe had allegedly fled west to escape the Mongols sometime in the mid to late 1200s. When his father died, Osman became bey, which is to say he was a regional chieftain. This ascension to power was likely not peaceful and included the normal Game of Thrones-style familial backstabbing you might expect of the late Byzantine era. With his capital located at the well-situated city of Sogut, yeah, not sure if that's how you pronounce that, and this for sure will not be my first mispronunciation, but I am trying my best. Sogut sat along an important road to Constantinople, and Osman looked westward as he began to pry territory away from the declining Byzantine Empire, incorporating this territory into his Islamic caliphate. Through a combination of sound administrative reform, as well as having a strategic location far enough west to avoid rival beyliks to the east and to avoid the old pesky Mongol invasion, Osman was able to rapidly transform the Ottomans into a regional power. Osman's beylik was also situated conveniently along the Silk Road, smack dab in the middle of the not-yet-fallen Byzantines to the west and the Mongols to the east. This gave them major economic advantages. During his rule, Osman fought the Byzantines as well as other rival Turkic beyliks. Osman's most important victory came when he captured the Karakhazar castles in 1288. According to legend, Osman took this city from the Byzantines, though it is likely that the Byzantines had actually already left well before this time. Like I said, according to legend, we're in the misty past here. After Osman conquered Karakhazar, according to legend, he was recognized by the Seljuk Sultan as an honorable conqueror and guardian, and officially given the right to rule all of the land he had conquered. This is the moment when Osman I essentially became a sultan in all but name. The Ottomans, with Osman I as their leader, an Ottoman is just an anglicization of the name Osman, continued to expand at the expense of the collapsing powers of the Byzantines to the west and the Seljuk Sultanate to the east. Even though he never officially held the title of sultan, through the conquests and administrative reforms, Osman I established the Ottoman dynasty that would rule for about 600 years until it all came crashing down during World War I. Over the first 100 years or so of the Ottoman dynasty, the heirs of Osman I would further expand the empire, continuing to conquer Anatolia and eventually entering Europe in the mid-1300s, conquering a portion of the Balkans, an area that would consistently be a centerpiece of their empire. During this period of Ottoman rise, in the 1300s and early 1400s, the Ottomans did not yet have a centralized state bureaucracy. Instead, the Ottoman rulers used what were called gazi to help them wage war and to conquer. The gazi were warriors or raiders who fought on the frontiers of the expanding Ottoman territory. The Ottoman leaders, including Osman I, were themselves considered gazis, and the warrior gazis who fought on their behalf simply thought of the Ottoman leaders as the first among equals, rather than as a sovereign authority. In the past, people have overplayed the religious nature of the Ghazi warriors and the idea of a holy war being a central component of the Ottoman rise. While the idea of a holy war has been shown to be of less importance than previously thought, the ability of Ottoman rulers to harness the power of these Ghazi warriors was definitely an essential facet of their rise to regional power. It was during this time of early Ottoman expansion that the first Janissary units began to be formed. A Janissary was essentially a member of an elite military unit directly answerable to the Ottoman Sultan. The Janissary units were one of the earliest modern standing armies in this period, and were primarily made up of soldiers who had been taken as slaves as children, usually from subject Christian peoples of the Balkans, such as Albanians, Greeks, Bulgarians, Romanians, and Serbs. These children were pressed into military service and forced to convert to Islam. Even though they were enslaved, the Janissaries were paid a salary and were known for their internal cohesion. The Janissaries were also not allowed to have children, and because of this, they came to be known for their at times fanatical loyalty to the Sultan. The emergence of the Janissaries was part of a larger process of gradual state centralization that really began to take hold nearing the end of the 14th century. This shift occurred most prominently in the military, as the Ottoman system shifted away from a confederation of warlords and began to incorporate a more recognizable military hierarchy. Murad I then became the first Ottoman ruler to declare himself as Sultan. As they conquered territory, Murad I and subsequent sultans began to dole out feudal privileges, which would form the so-called tamar system, which was when revenue from conquered land was given in exchange for military service. These land grants would enrich those in the army and create a military caste ever more loyal to the Sultan. These centralization practices gradually transformed the Ottoman sultans from being a first among equals amongst the Ghazi warriors to being a true sovereign authority. This centralization process was completed with the rule of Mehmed II. Mehmed II, or Mehmed the Conqueror, was technically made sultan for a short 2 years in 1444 when he was just 12 years old. Mehmed's father, the Sultan Murad II, had tried to relinquish the throne peacefully to his son, a foolish thing to try to do, and a revolt of the Janissaries forced Murad to return to the throne. Mehmed would come to power in his own right when his father died in 1451, when Mehmed was 19. After just 2 years on the throne, the ever-industrious Mehmed had conquered Constantinople and brought an end to the over 1,000-year-old Byzantine Empire, which, you know, is not bad for a 21-year-old. Once he had the great city, Mehmed moved the capital of the Ottoman Empire to Constantinople, which was both a geographic and a symbolic shift away from the power of the central Anatolian Ghazi warriors and towards the old imperial capital of Byzantium. After Mehmed conquered the Byzantines, he proclaimed himself Caesar of Rome and would for the rest of his life consider the Ottoman Empire as simply a continuation of the Roman Byzantine Empire. Along with taking Constantinople, Mehmed further expanded into Anatolia to the east and into southeastern Europe to the west. He also went as far north as the Crimea in modern-day Russia on the north end of the Black Sea. As Mehmed was conquering the areas around the Danube River in modern-day Romania, he ran into some trouble when he faced off against Vlad the Impaler. Also known as Vlad Dracula, Vlad is today a Romanian national hero and the vampiric inspiration for Count Dracula. Before he was a vampire, though, Vlad was an impaler. As leader of what is today modern-day Romania, an area that was at this point loosely under Ottoman control, Vlad had for years been snubbing the authority of the Ottomans by refusing to pay the tribute required of him. When the Sultan sent envoys to force the payment, rather than pay the tribute, Vlad instead proceeded to impale the envoys and then launch an invasion into Ottoman territory, killing thousands of Turks living in the Balkans. As you might expect, Mehmed the Conqueror was pretty pissed at this point, so he invaded Romania with a gigantic army of like hundreds of thousands of troops. The Sultan and his army were camped outside of the Romanian capital when Vlad, apparently disguised himself as a Turk, snuck into the Ottoman camp and began looking for the Sultan's tent, planning to assassinate Mehmed the Conqueror. Now, This strategy was more common than you might think, and had actually been the demise of Mehmed's great-great-grandfather, the OG Sultan Murad I. When Murad I was himself out conquering in the Balkans, you know, a real pastime for the Ottoman sultans, he was facing off against the Serbs at the Battle of Kosovo, when a legendary Serbian knight, Miloš Obilić, broke into the Ottoman camp and assassinated the sultan. The knight was thereafter executed, and the martyrdom of Miloš and his accomplices formed the basis of what's called the Kosovo cult that would serve as a lasting example of resistance to Ottoman occupation in Serbia and would later become one of the founding myths of Serbian nationalism. 70 years later, Sultan Mehmed I, for his part, was able to escape the fate of his great-great-grandfather, because Vlad Dracula was not able to find his way to the Sultan's tent. The Ottomans had probably learned their lesson and would no longer advertise the whereabouts of the Sultan to, you know, mysterious men asking mysterious questions. Vlad was undeterred, though, and he gave the signal for a night attack against the camp, which was hugely successful and led to heavy losses for the Ottomans. Though his forces had been depleted after this surprise attack, the Sultan pushed on and still aimed to take the Romanian capital. As the Sultan's forces moved forward, however, they ran into a truly horrifying sight, as the road they marched on was apparently lined with literally tens of thousands of impaled Turks for, like, dozens of miles. One Ottoman soldier described the scene as a, quote, forest of the impaled, and you probably have guessed by now, this is where old Vlad got his name. I read a little book about Vlad the Impaler. All of this was pretty freaky for the Ottomans, and though they would retain control of Romania, it would always be a bit of a sticky place for them. And within the Balkans, characters such as the Serbian martyr Miloš Obilić and then the Romanian hero Vlad the Impaler would serve as inspiration for later generations who sought to resist Ottoman rule. And these near mythological figures would be important in forging an early Pan-Slavic identity. These refusals to bow to the Sultan are also good examples of how resistance against imperial rule would never really go away within these conquered territories of the empire, especially amongst Christian populations. For Mehmed, however, the Balkans were simply one part of a much larger process of Ottoman expansion. And after the conquests of Mehmed, the Ottoman Empire would enter a period in which it would reach its zenith in terms of territorial expansion, political power, and cultural, artistic, and scientific development. Mehmed's rule brought about the so-called Classical Age of the Ottoman Empire. By this time, most of the imperial structures that would define the Ottoman Empire were now fully entrenched. Imperial succession was an extremely fraught business within the Ottoman Empire. Lots of backstabbing in the quite literal sense. The continuation of the line of Osman I was the top priority of the imperial dynasty, and so all male sons of the Sultan were technically eligible to succeed their father as Sultan. This meant that there were intense rivalries pitting the sons of the Sultan against one another literally from the time they were born. These rivalries were intensified by the fact that the sultans would often father their sons with many different women within the imperial harem. The structure of the Ottoman imperial harem is incredibly complicated, but the basics are that the sultan was surrounded by a hierarchical structure of women, with the sultan's mother at the top of the harem. Then the harem was further filled with enslaved, typically Christian women who were the Sultan's concubines. These women came from all over the empire and symbolized the diverse and cosmopolitan nature of the empire. What was most sought after within the structure of the harem was to win the approval of the Sultan with the eventual goal of mothering the Sultan a son. The harem was therefore filled with half-brothers, all locked in a sort of Darwinian death match, vying for power and hoping to gain the sultanate upon their father's death. The mother-son relationship was especially important within this structure, as there was a policy of one mother per one son within the sultan's harem. The mothers of these potential sultans would try to put their sons in the best position possible to take imperial power, and they would often be the true wielders of power when the princes would, at a young age, go off to act as provincial governors, a time that served as a trial for potential future sultans. These mothers of Ottoman princes held an especially interesting position within the empire, as they were more often than not enslaved minorities who had been captured during their youth and taken from the periphery of the empire, from areas such as the Balkans to the imperial capital to serve as concubines. These women would at times rise to become literally the most powerful person in the entire empire as the mother or consort of the sultan. One of these bloody imperial struggles played out upon the death of Mehmed the Conqueror in 1481. There were two primary claimants to the throne, Mehmed's two sons, Bayezid and Jim. Jim was the son of Mehmed's wife, while Bayezid was the son of an Albanian concubine. Like all Ottoman princes, the two sons were working as provincial governors when they learned of their father's death. When Mehmed died, the two claimants literally got on their horses and raced to the capital, as the first to arrive at the imperial palace was often the one able to secure their rule. The younger brother, Jim, had schemed with the Grand Vizier, essentially the Prime Minister, to allow him to become the next sultan. His brother Bayezid, however, had previously won the support of the all-important Janissaries. So, when the scheming of Jim and the Grand Vizier came to light, the Janissaries rebelled and subsequently killed the Grand Vizier. Rioting then gripped Constantinople until influential leaders swooped in to control the chaos, declaring Bayezid sultan in May of 1481. Even though he had been outmaneuvered, Jim was able to dodge the attempts that his half-brother Bayezid made to kill him. While in exile, Jim would continue to vie for the throne for nearly 15 years, traveling throughout the courts of Europe as he tried to win support for an always aspirational attempt on the Ottoman throne. And Jim's schemes would insert an early interest within Western Europe for meddling in the business of Ottoman succession. Towards the end of his 30-year reign, Bayezid began to have internal struggles of his own amongst his many sons. And during the struggle to win the sultan's approval, Bayezid let slip that he had a preference for one of his sons, Ahmed, to succeed him as sultan. Upon learning this, another of Bayezid's sons, Selim, then took an unprecedented action as he rebelled against his father and his brother. All of this infighting resulted in a years-long civil war that ended when Selim successfully dethroned his father in 1512. The Janissaries, yet again, proved decisive as they forced poor old Bayezid to abdicate in favor of his rebellious son Selim. After having now nearly been killed by no less than two of his sons, Bayezid would die only a month into his forced retirement. Upon taking the throne, Selim put all of his brothers and all of his nephews to death. Ottoman succession was quite a bloody affair. These violent beginnings would lead Selim to be dubbed Selim the Grim. And though Selim only ruled as sultan for 8 years, his reign saw massive territorial expansion take place, especially within the Muslim world, as he conquered the Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt. The Mamluk conquest brought under Ottoman control Egypt, the Levant, large swaths of the Arabian Peninsula, and perhaps most significantly, the Hejaz, with its Islamic holy cities of Mecca and Medina. Selim's conquest of large parts of the Muslim Middle East brought great prestige to the Ottomans, making them the preeminent Muslim power, and Selim was considered the first true Ottoman caliph, a term denoting the leader of the wider Muslim world. As a result of this expansion east, the center of power within the empire shifted during this period, away from the European Balkans to the west and towards the Asian Middle East. Selim died only 8 years after taking the throne, but he left behind a vast multi-ethnic empire spanning across three continents. Upon Selim's death, Suleiman the Magnificent ascended to the throne in 1520, though much less contentiously than his father and grandfather, as he was, somewhat mysteriously, the only son of Slim. Who knows? Maybe Slim had learned a thing or two from his bloody youth and sought to save his own son from deadly headaches of succession. Suleiman's rule was truly the peak of Ottoman power and influence in the world. When he took the helm, Suleiman pretty much immediately picked up where his father left off, as he, like all good sultans, went a-conquering, with some of his first ventures looking further west into Europe, where he would eventually take on the Hungarians, driving them out of Belgrade in 1521. The taking of Belgrade, the strategically important trading hub on the Danube River and today's capital of modern Serbia, would fully solidify Ottoman control of Serbia. The Ottomans would go on to rule Serbia, not without significant resistance, of course, all the way up until 1804 with the beginning of the Serbian Revolution, the launching pad for other such nationalistic movements in the surrounding Ottoman Balkans. A key development during this time was the unprecedented Franco-Ottoman alliance, in which King Francis I of France allied himself with Suleiman and the Ottomans, with the principal motivating factor being the common enemy of the Holy Roman Emperor, the Habsburg Charles V. The Franco-Ottoman alliance was one of the earliest alliances of its kind as a strategic partnership between a Muslim and a Christian power, and it would be extremely important for both countries for some 300 years, lasting all the way up until Napoleon. An early request within this alliance was made by Francis I for the Ottomans to put pressure on the Holy Roman Empire, and as this nicely fit in with Suleiman's own ambitions, this request led directly to further Ottoman attacks on Hungary in 1526. This war culminated at the consequential Battle of Mohács, when the Ottomans defeated the Hungarians and during which the Hungarian king died. The unfortunate man fell backwards off his horse into a stream and then was drowned by the weight of his armor. You know, if you're wearing armor, make sure you take a buddy along with you, because you might just fall into a stream. This defeat would lead to years of civil war in Hungary and would eventually spell an end to the independent Kingdom of Hungary. Amidst this chaos, the Ottomans would move as far west as Vienna, putting the city under siege in 1529. Suleiman did not successfully take the city, however, the Ottoman position in Hungary was greatly strengthened, with an Ottoman vassal taking control of the Hungarian capital of Buda. The failed siege of Vienna would launch a rivalry between the Austrian Habsburgs and the Ottomans that would last for over a century, and which would lead Hungary to become a battleground of sorts for the 200 years of near constant warfare between the Ottomans and the Habsburgs. Suleiman then took on the Safavid Persian Empire to the east beginning in 1532, eventually capturing Baghdad and gaining access to the Persian Gulf. Suleiman would also expand further into Africa, taking Tripoli in modern-day Libya in 1551. Even though there would be small expansions after his death, it is really under Suleiman the Magnificent that the Ottoman Empire reached its height, with the Sultan ruling a population of over 20 million people. Within the empire itself, this period was marked by relative stability and economic growth. During this time, Suleiman put through a series of significant political and administrative reforms, and in Turkey, Suleiman is often most remembered by the moniker Suleiman the Lawgiver. Perhaps the most significant of these reforms came in the making of the so-called Ottoman Laws, which were essentially a uniform and rationalized legal code that covered everything from criminal law to tax codes. Suleiman also supported the arts and education, as hundreds of artistic societies were created, leading to a golden age of arts and culture. Suleiman's reign also marked the beginning of the so-called Sultanate of Women, a period of over 100 years when women within the Sultan's harem had pronounced power and influence in the empire. The first of these powerful women was the wife of Suleiman the Magnificent, a woman known in Europe as Roxolana. As a young girl, Roxolana had been taken from her home in modern-day Ukraine during a raid by Crimean Tatars. Roxolana was thereafter enslaved and taken to the imperial palace, where she was gifted to Suleiman by his mother. Roxolana entered into Suleiman's harem around the time he became sultan, and she quickly rose within the harem, going from being an enslaved concubine to being the wife of Suleiman. Roxolana and Suleiman unprecedentedly broke the rule of one concubine, one son, and had several sons together. They even for a time had, can you believe it, a monogamous relationship. Roxolana eventually became known in the empire as Harem Sultan, meaning the cheerful one, because of her playful personality. During her reign, Roxolana Harem was especially influential as a philanthropist, leading many public works projects such as mosques, schools, medical centers, and soup kitchens for the poor. Though wars with other great powers, such as the Habsburgs, would continue off and on for hundreds of years, the Ottoman expansion had pretty much reached its limit with the conquests of Suleiman the Magnificent. In the years after Suleiman, the Ottoman Empire would continue to be one of the most powerful empires in both Europe and Asia. However, the nature of the Ottoman state as an expansionist empire would begin to change, changes that we will cover next episode. Ottoman power would eventually begin to decline, especially at the beginning of the 19th century. This decline would be defined by a series of significant military defeats, increasing corruption within the Ottoman imperial bureaucracy, and the rise of European states forging global empires whose power would begin to eclipse old-style land-based empires such as the Ottomans. All of these developments would lead to the potentially hyperbolic naming of the Ottoman Empire as the sick man of Europe, a term first coined by the rival Russian Empire in the mid-19th century. The troubles facing the imperial leadership would further intensify as a rising tide of nationalism began to take hold within the Ottoman provinces beginning in the early 1800s. This anti-imperial nationalism would lead to countless revolutionary movements across the empire, beginning with the Serbian Revolution in 1804 and then spreading to the Greek War of Independence in 1821, events that would help spark more than a dozen similar struggles spanning all the way from Romania to Arabia. Then finally, this revolutionary fervor would culminate in the forging of a nationalistic identity within Turkey itself, first with the rise of the Young Turks, and later with the struggle for Turkish independence under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. But before we get to the Turkish War of Independence, we must first understand what made the Ottoman man sick. And one vital factor in the 19th century Ottoman decline would be the dramatic rise in revolutionary activity in the Balkans. So, join me next time as we consider the many changes that took place within the Ottoman Empire after Suleiman. And then, we will try to understand why this centuries-old empire would struggle to stop the Serbs in their revolutionary fight for national independence.